Today's show is sponsored by Bob's Red Mill. With natural foods, they support organic, vegan, paleo, and gluten-free lifestyles. Learn more about their commitment to good food for all at bobsredmill.com/podcast.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. We're a member-supported food radio network broadcasting over 35 weekly shows live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. Join our hosts as they lead you through the world of craft brewing, behind the scenes of the restaurant industry, inside the battle over school food, and beyond. Find us at heritageradionetwork.org.
Hi, everybody. Welcome to the show. And, oh, man, where do I even start this week?
I don't know, but you got to start somewhere because this is a big story.
Well, first of all, my wife, Caitlin, is back from a trip and helping me. If you didn't hear the Amanda Freitag show 2 episodes ago, I'm trying to do these intros without a script, and it seems to help me to have another person here. So Caitlin is back in the co-pilot seat for the introduction of the show. Thank you.
Oh, my pleasure.
So this is not a current event show. The show I used to do with Jimmy Bradley called The Front Burner here on Heritage was a current event show, and I wish I had a current event show right now because everybody, even people who probably aren't, you know, foodies or people who are in the industry have probably seen, in the more general world, a couple weeks ago, there was the Harvey Weinstein story broke. And in the restaurant industry this weekend, the John Besh story broke. Brett Anderson of the Times-Picayune spent months working on a piece. He interviewed about 25 women, who've all came forward with stories of harassment, I guess we'd say coercion, and other really horrible behavior under the umbrella of John Besh's restaurant company. Yesterday, I'm recording this Tuesday. On Monday, John Besh left his own company. As we sit here on Tuesday morning, Cosmo Goss, who co-authored The Publican Cookbook and is the chef of The Publican, is out of The Publican, and that was a one-incident event. There was apparently, and the details are a little vague in the news, but an inappropriate photograph, as it was described, of a female employee was being circulated in the company, and Cosmo, had seen it, been aware of it, as the leader, at least, of the kitchen, didn't do anything to curtail it and put an end to it, and he is now out of the company. I suspect that event, the way it was described, was already in motion before the news broke this weekend. In the wake of the Besh story, I think we're going to start seeing stories like this on a semi-daily basis. It's going to be painful. I think it is, as we were talking before the show, it's a really bad thing. What happened in the past, it's a very good thing what's about to happen, although ripping this Band-Aid off is going to be, I think, genuinely shocking to a lot of people. And I didn't know how to start a show that has chefs in the name and to be a part of this community, not immediately, but as someone who writes about it, and not address this moment at the top of this show. So I just did want to take a moment. And I will say, it has been, maybe I'm naive. Maybe this just speaks to the obviously vastly different experiences of men and women. But the women I have been speaking to since the Weinstein story broke, and I used to work in the film business, I'm not shocked that this kind of thing goes on. I am shocked by the frequency of it.
How
blatant and seemingly unapologetic, but also just, you know, it seems to happen not quite in plain sight, but in ways that are just, the behavior's amazing. I don't even know, it's almost inconceivable. And it also, I have to say, having spent the amount of time in the number of kitchens that I've spent it in, I have never seen it. I've never heard talk of it. You do hear whispers about, oh, so-and-so's kind of a dog and that kind of stuff. But, you know, I'm not going to apply this to anyone specific. I don't want to get sued. But, you know, the criminal behavior that's basically institutionalized, it seems, is breathtaking. It's absolutely breathtaking. And not a single woman I've discussed this with over a coffee or a drink or on the phone or by email is surprised.
I'm not surprised at all.
Right. So it is, it's a very illuminating moment, I think, for a lot of people. I guess mostly for men. So, and I think probably a very empowering moment for women, which is as it should be. And I did want to say, while this is not a current event show, if there is a chef out there, and I'll put this out there very broadly, I don't know if it would be a female chef, which probably seems most appropriate, or a male chef, or maybe a male and a female chef together. But I would be happy, not happy is the wrong word, I would like to spend an episode of this show on this topic. It's not really what this show is designed to be, and this is meant as a biographical show. It's meant as sort of a bantery, fun show for people. But again, I just felt like I didn't know how to start a show this week about this without mentioning this subject. And people can get in touch with me pretty easily. You can DM me on one of my social media accounts, which on Instagram and Twitter, that's Toqueland Andrew, Toqueland Andrew. The show's account is at Chef Podcast, also on Twitter and Instagram, or you could shoot me an email. It's Andrew at Toqueland, Toqueland.com. I do only do in-person interviews. It's the only way I feel like a show of this length works. So it would need to be somebody based in New York or who was visiting New York or who wanted an excuse to come to New York. But please reach out because it's something that I would like to, devote at least one show to doing. I do think it's something that's going to very much, it's going to be the story of the industry for the remainder of this year and probably a good piece of next year. And also I think other industries, you know, we haven't really seen it break out yet in the political world where that is inevitable. And you know, there'll be more entertainment industry pieces. The James Toback story broke this year. And again, that, I have to say, was one story that was not at all shocking to me. People have been talking in the worst terms about that guy since I was still in the business, which was in the 90s. In any event, all of that said, let's get on to this week's show, which, having spent, you know, the last couple of minutes mired in the mud, we have a delightful show for everybody. Stephen Harris. And Stephen, I'm really sorry that we had to start your show off this way. It's just... you know, you're a former history teacher. Current events sometimes intrude. Stephen is, first of all, our first international guest. He is from the UK. He is the chef owner of The Sportsman, which is in Seasalter, Kent. The Sportsman is a Michelin-starred restaurant. For the last 2 years, both in 2016 and 2017, The Sportsman won top honors, the top spot in the National Restaurant Awards, named the best restaurant in the UK the last 2 years. And the reason Stephen is in New York is he is on a promotional tour for his brand new cookbook, The Sportsman. That's the title. There's no subtitle. It's simply called The Sportsman, after the restaurant. And it is a book that, not having been to the restaurant, I think I could say I feel like I've been there from this book. It really captures what the restaurant is known for, which is Stephen's very personal, very intelligent take on what he refers to as the terroir of the area where the restaurant is located, making use of the ingredients of the area, of the produce of the area, of, you know, it's right on the coastline. He even makes his own salt. That is something that really comes through in the book, which is basically divided into Stephen's story, profiles of key people in the restaurant, and 50 recipes from the restaurant. Stephen is a former punk rocker. He had at least two other careers that I know of, and didn't find the kitchen professionally until almost the age of 30. And we get into his entire story in this interview, which took place at his hotel in the Flatiron area of New York City this Monday. So I think that's all. Do I need to say anything else? Oh, well, thank you. It's all him. It's all him. He's a smart, charming, engaging guy with just a fascinating story. And that's it. That's all I have to say. So, which is a lot this week. Anyway, with all that and with the abrupt shift in tone, I do hope everyone enjoys what I think is a delightful interview with the delightful Stephen Harris of The Sportsman, recorded this Monday in New York City. Here you go. It's gonna take a prolonged arrangement of the senses to make some sense of this. So how long since you arrived in New York?
I came in yesterday.
Yesterday, so Sunday.
Yep. And just today.
Yeah. Adjusting.
Adjusting.
Acclimating.
Yeah. Knackered now. Middle of the afternoon. I'll be wide awake at 2 a.m.
Right. So I should say we're in your hotel room.
Yeah.
But we do have a chaperone. We do have
We're not
Meg Parsons from Fiden. Yes.
Yeah.
Thank you for making the time to join us today.
That's all right. Perfect.
It's funny. We just met for the first time. I don't know what to call it. Do people call you chef? Do you go in for that? Seem like someone who doesn't go in for that part of the game.
I am exactly the opposite.
Yeah.
In fact, when I first went in a professional kitchen and everybody kept saying, yes, chef, I thought they were saying Jeff. I thought the chef's name was Jeff. And I didn't realize that's what you do.
Yes.
It's a very funny thing. I'm particularly amused at how quickly and easily Americans will adopt the French manner, like they do it with restaurants as well.
You mean in the dining room as well?
Yeah, the French is the language of great food.
Yes,
which is understandable. Like English is the language of whatever commerce, maybe, I don't know. Sure. Yeah, we all
literature.
Have, yeah, maybe, but it's just weird.
Intelligence.
Yeah, well, I hope. Yeah, but you know what I mean.
Modesty.
French kind of is the language of restaurants. So it's quite strange because you hear somebody like Gordon Ramsay talking fluent French. And of course,
sure.
Remember, of course, he lived there for a couple of years.
Well, what's funny to me is that that's persisted. I mean, you now have Spain as a culinary world power, and Scandinavia obviously is very much involved, but the way the French language still gets tossed around a kitchen,
that's quite nice.
It's still kind of, that's never really gone away.
It's quite romantic. I think we challenge it a bit more in English because we live next to the French,
right?
So we're a bit more chippy.
You're a bit more invested
thing.
In.
Well, the thing is, we invented, as far as the world's concerned, the French invented cooking, and we invented football.
Yeah.
So, now they're better at football than we are.
Okay.
So, we want to be better at cooking than them.
Yes.
Maybe.
Yeah.
One day.
So how did you, you have a very, you had a long and winding road to the kitchen.
Yeah.
But why don't you tell me a little bit about where you grew up and what you thought you were going to do with your life before you found yourself cooking?
Yes. Grew up in Whitstable, which is the if anybody knows, is 60 miles from London.
Okay. In which direction?
East, uh-huh. And the North Kent coast.
Okay.
The North Kent coast is the coast of the Thames estuary.
Okay.
So as the Thames flows out of London, it eventually reaches Whitstable and the widest part of the estuary, which is where we are. And that is it's known as the home of the oyster.
Okay.
So it's Oyster Town. And Whitstable was built pretty much on a on the oyster trade, so that was the town that I grew up in. I was quite good at school. I used to do well. I ended up at university studying history at King's College in London, which is a good university.
What did you think you were going to do with that degree?
Well, I didn't really know. I that was one of the problems, was that I didn't really know. I instantly react against being put into a box. And they even called it, at the end of the university, they used to have something called the milk round. And that was where you would go to a kind of a big conference hall or something, and all of the big companies,
sure,
the accountancy firms.
This is what we call a career fair here in the
States.
Career
fair. Well, we called it the milk round, which makes it sound fairly, which makes you feel like you're being cattled into a career in accountancy or anything like that. That idea horrified me. So I think I'd already been through the punk years. And I've been realizing more and more over the last few weeks as I've been talking about the book that punk was such an important thing to for your attitude.
Yes.
You know, musically, it wasn't any great shakes. It was pretty much 60s garage bands turned up a bit more.
Yes.
But it was... the attitude was there, which was that I didn't really like being told what to do. I didn't like authority. I don't mind it if somebody knows what they're doing or there's a reason, but I have felt that there were a lot of people who hadn't really earned the right to tell you what to do, telling you what to do.
Or that it was if I'm going to make an assumption, please tell me if I'm wrong, but also that there were these sort of predetermined pathways for a young person were not really examined. They were sort of by rote. There was a path that you followed. It was you go to school and you take up a profession, and usually it's something that involves probably a sport coat and or a suit and a tie, and that's what you did.
Yeah, that's right. And I reacted against that. I didn't want to be an accountant. I didn't want to be a lawyer. These were all the things that all my friends have gone on to. I mean, of course, they're all now millionaires and own law firms in London and all that kind of stuff. So, you know.
But you're happy.
But that's the weird thing. When I meet up with a group of old friends, I'm the one that everyone goes, wow, that was great. You know, because I think I'm always the one that everyone's like, oh, well, you really kind of did it on your own terms.
Right.
And you broke
out of the mold. You're like like the old Apple commercial. You're the one who broke out of the line and threw the thing through the screen.
Maybe that's why that seems to be the way. Because like you said, I grew up in a town. I was sports mad, you know. I was cricket and football, and then
were athletic.
I was a very good cricketer. Mm-hmm. I kind of had trials for Kent.
Oh, so, really?
You know, I was one of the top kind of quite a good cricketer of my generation. I was a very good footballer, but I had a really bad car crash when I was very young, and I broke both my legs and my arm, and I was in hospital for 6 months, and I couldn't play football for 2 years.
Oh, man.
Because of complications.
Was that heartbreaking?
It was I was only 10, and I know it sounds silly, but I was kind of I was already well on the way. You know, I assumed that I'd be a footballer. That was what I wanted to be.
Oh, man.
I then played cricket instead, and I did very well at cricket.
Cricket,
but never... I think that's one of the reasons why this time round I knew how hard you have to work to really make a success of something. Because I'd been quite good at everything. You know, I was quite good academically. I was quite good at sports.
Were you naturally good at these things, or did it require a lot of work on your behalf?
No, quite naturally.
You were very good.
It annoyed my family a lot. My brothers particularly, because...
They wish they'd had your talent.
I just found things quite easy, and I don't know why, but it kind of can count against you because you get a bit lazy.
Yeah.
You know, like when you really, like with this, to become what the sportsman has become,
yes,
I had to kind of learn my lesson from, you know, why didn't I follow through with the sport and the music, you know, because we also had a record contract when I was 15, you know.
Yeah, well, before we move off that, can I get this story from you? What was your history with music? Because it does come up. Come up in the context of food, which we'll get to in a little bit. But can we get sort of the thumbnail version of your musical career?
Okay. So that was a G, by the way. My musical thing was that I loved music from a very early age. I had an older brother who was big into music, and so you know when you got an older brother, you kind of get into stuff maybe earlier than other people.
Yeah, sure.
So...
Because you have a guide.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And during the... to put it in context, before punk happened, we were like punks before it happened. We didn't like the way music was going. It was very much kind of Led Zeppelin, Pink Floyd, Emerson, Lake and Palmer, great big shows that cost millions of pounds, banks and banks of very expensive equipment.
Yeah.
And music had kind of pulled away from a little band in a club, which is what I think great rock and roll music is. It's a small band in a club. You know, I'd love to see the Beatles at Shea Stadium, but it was over by then, wasn't it? It was the Cavern. That's what your dream is to see. I saw like, you know, when I was growing up, Joe Strummer in his band Before the Clash in a
amazing
room about this size.
Did you have any sense of seeing someone like that, of what they were going to become?
Joe Strummer was a superstar.
You knew that when you saw him?
The second you saw him.
Yeah.
You just knew you're in the presence of somebody seriously special. I saw The Jam in a room, a tiny little room, you know. Yeah. All these bands before. So when punk came along, I was already playing guitar, but I'd been listening. We'd been listening, like all of the punks in England, we'd been listening to the MC5, Iggy and the Stooges, the New York Dolls, a lot of American music. Also the 60s English garage bands that never made it. And then that kind of American weird thing, because everyone was watching England during the 60s.
Sure.
However good a band you were in America in the mid-60s, and you know, there are a few exceptions, nobody heard your music.
Didn't matter.
So yeah. We went back and covered things like Question Mark and the Mysterians, 96 Tears, the Standells, you know, and people like that, yeah. And the Seeds, and these kind of bands. And songs like Sometimes Good Guys Don't Wear White. So there was all this great music which no one had heard. And like a lot of movements, we kind of got into all that side of things. And when punk came along, we were kind of ready. We were almost waiting for something to happen.
This sort of gave voice to what was going on in your heads individually and as a group conversationally. It and it sort of put voice to all that and rhythm.
Exactly. It resonated with us.
Just to contextualize, we don't have to say your exact age, and we won't say my exact age, but you were literally a child of the 60s. You were a child in the 60s.
I was born in the 60s. I was born in 1961, so I was 15 when punk came along.
Okay. Just to contextualize
15,
this for people.
I was a teenager. I was ready for it. I already could play the guitar a bit.
Yeah.
And and we were already playing kind of, you know, these kind of Chuck Berry kind of style stuff, but very loud. A bit like, very like the New York Dolls. They were, we covered a few of their songs. We did Trash and Pills by the New York Dolls. We loved Chuck Berry and Bo Diddley.
Yeah.
You know, that was what we were. And we loved the Beatles and the Stones as well.
Sure.
You know. So, but we just wanted exciting music. We didn't want, you know, I tried to listen to Tales from a Topographic Ocean by Yes, and I fell asleep until somebody went on the synthesizer.
In terms of you musically, though, you were self-taught, is that correct?
Yeah.
And how did you even know that you were capable of teaching yourself something that most people would think to go out and hire an instructor for?
Yeah. It's funny, isn't it? But back then, there was nobody who could teach you how to play rock and roll guitar. It was like you had to start off, I said Frankie and Johnny, you know, you had to start off with all this kind of folk guitar before you know, there was no way of learning. So I did this is why I see parallels with the food. I did what I did with food. I went to gigs, stood at the front and watched the guitarist.
Yeah.
Then I went home, talk to as few people as possible, go home, and then copy what he did.
So you were looking at, it's funny, I'm a big tennis fan, and I have friends who will go to the US Open, get as close as they can to a court. They want to see the grips.
Exactly.
They want to see how the guys are holding their racket.
Yeah.
You were actually watching the hands.
Yeah.
And you would imitate that.
Yeah. And then I'd go home, get my guitar, and copy what, and that's how I learned how
and
to play.
And that was able to, that worked.
Yeah, that kind of Chuck Berry kind of rhythm and all that stuff, and the chord shapes.
And was this, were you obsessive about it? In other words, did you get good just through sort of trial and error and having a good ear and being able to sort of make corrections in your own?
Yeah, I guess so. Yeah, I actually haven't got a great ear. I can't do what other friends. I had another friend who could put a track on, you know, put on the old vinyl, put a track on and then work it out. I couldn't do that. So, but that can be good because I would try and play somebody else's songs, mess it up, and I had my own song.
Right.
So I became a composer through not being able to work to imitate out other people's
songs.
That's
very funny. Yeah. What about culinarily? What was your childhood like or your early years like in terms of how well you ate, however you would define that, and just your interest in food in general?
We ate well at home, but not, it wasn't, there was no suggestion of, you know, what came later. You know, we were just an ordinary family. My mum, there were five of us. So, you know, she just was a practical cook.
Sure.
So she, and you know, now looking back on it, you think, God, that was a, you know, if your mum's cooking shepherd's pie or, you know, that kind of cod and parsley sauce now, you'd think, wow, you'd lucked out. But back then that was just normal. So your mum would cook, you know, a really nice meal every night and you didn't feel like it was anything. But now looking back on it,
you had it pretty good.
Yeah, we did. It was good. It was nice. The interesting thing was my dad was a real estate agent for businesses, in particular restaurants. So say you had a restaurant and it, you know, you wanted to sell it.
Yeah.
You'd go into my dad's office.
Yes.
And sell, and you'd say to him, I've got a restaurant I want to sell. My dad's job was then to put you in touch with people who wanted to buy them.
Yes.
And that was, that was quite interesting because it meant that we felt very comfortable as a family in the world of restaurants.
Yes.
So my dad would take us, you know, we'd go, I mean, not, I'm not talking great restaurants, but my dad would take us, you know, we were familiar with them, you know, and we felt comfortable among, yes, in restaurants, which I guess is maybe not normal, you know, mm-hmm, if I could think of anything that made us stand out. I was always obsessed by flavour and taste.
You were?
I mean, yeah, I remember on the way back from school making all my friends come round to taste a baked bread roll.
It excited
with
you.
With ice cold butter on it, warm out of the oven. And I just would get obsessed by things like that.
And you wanted to share it?
Yeah.
Which is a very chefy, yeah,
exactly,
sort of instinct.
And I was 14, you know.
Interesting.
So, yeah, you know, silly little things like, have you tasted how good a freshly baked bread roll is with a big slab of butter?
Right, the way another kid might play a piece of music for somebody,
yeah,
or
I guess so.
Play
a sport,
tell a joke.
Know, or, yeah, yeah, exactly.
Or show them a comedian or...
So, I guess...
You wanted other people to experience... You wanted to share that experience.
Yeah, slightly evangelical about a bread roll and butter. But, you
right,
know, it's not a bad analogy for what came, yeah, later, really.
So you end up going... professional, I guess we say. Mm-hmm. For how long? How long were you in what career did you find yourself in ultimately?
Oh, after university.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I went to London and studied history.
Mm-hmm.
And then for 3 years, I was a history teacher.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't really know what to do. And it was the first job I applied for and I got.
Yeah.
You know? So I taught history for 3 years, which I loved.
You did.
But it was just great, you know, kind of 11 to 16 year olds. It was nothing. Highly academic.
So this was general world history, you'd say.
Yeah, yeah. And I really enjoyed it. I loved dealing with kids, you know, every day. They're such good fun to be with.
Mm-hmm.
And trying to make history exciting.
Yes.
I was very kind of keen on that.
Did you bring having been a musician, did you bring sort of an element of performance? I don't mean in any extravagant way, but do you feel like that gave you a comfort level?
Oh, I think that helps if you're a teacher.
Yeah, that's what I mean. Yeah,
yeah, I think if you're a teacher, to be an engaging person in front of them is important. You see, I taught in a kind of inner city London school that was quite rough, but I always thought it's my job to make the subject interesting. These kids will mess around if you let them.
Sure.
But if you fill the vacuum with interesting ideas, you know, say you'd say, you know, I used to do something called the School's History Project, which was an attempt in England to make history very much about, you know, more interesting. And you'd say, you'd create a paradox, say, why did America lose the Vietnam War? Sorry if that's news to anyone, but do you know what I mean?
Hopefully not to my listeners,
but
you never know.
But you know what I mean? How did the most powerful country in the world lose a war, in a sense, to this tiny little bunch of guys on a load of bicycles, you know?
Yeah.
And, of course, to solve that paradox, because they all knew the Vietnam War, because there were loads of, like, Rambo and all those films coming out then. And so... To solve that paradox, you need to understand concepts. So one would say, why didn't they just nuke them, sir? And it would be like, why didn't they? And then another one would say, well, maybe they weren't... You couldn't really use them. What if the fallout went into China, you know?
Yes.
And then they'd start understanding, and that's geopolitics, and you've got a load of 11, 12-year-olds.
Right.
Or maybe a bit older, 13, 14-year-olds, understanding concepts and and using concepts, which... If you were trying to teach them in a strict academic way, they would never be able to grasp, and yet they were understanding.
So you were able to bring an immediacy to what to a lot of people seems like just something that happens almost just in the pages of a book.
Yeah, yeah, that's right. And trying to make it real, because they do understand these ideas, because they're interactions with human beings. They understand these ideas, but as soon as it becomes academic and part of school, they kind of tune out.
Yeah, right? It's funny, when I went to Columbia University here in New York City, and Brzezinski, who had been what was the title, National Security Director, I think.
Mm.
Might be wrong on the exact title, but at the end of the course, I never took this course, but it was famous at the time. He created a world crisis situation, and you were supposed to make your recommendation to the president.
Oh, right.
That was the final exam.
Really?
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, I remember on one of them, one of the possible options was nuke 'em, ?
Yeah.
But it was...
Yeah, but that's
there's
right.
There's nothing like making those things palpable to
they
someone.
They are, and in a group discussion particularly, because one person will say, well, you know, they've got nuclear weapons, why didn't they use them? And then all of the objections to it come along. Well, you can't, you know, fallout, you know, it would look really bad, you know, like bullying and blah, blah, and all these kind of things. And that's politics. That's geopolitics.
That's when you break it down, that's what it is.
So you've got a load of kids who are trying to solve, but the reason they're drawn in is because they know about the Vietnam War, because lots of films are being made about it, so they're interested.
Right.
So if you can get them to solve, and they are interested in lots of things, princes in the tower, you know, about the English princes who were murdered by Richard the Second, you know, Richard the Third. And you get that kind of, you know, you've just got to draw them in with an interesting subject, you know.
So how do you, I'm sorry, after teaching history, I don't want to jump ahead.
Well, I didn't earn any money and I couldn't afford to go out in London when I was a teacher. So a friend of mine was working in the city, which is, you know, Wall Street.
Mm-hmm.
So the equivalent of Wall Street, and said, do you want to come and work for me as a financial consultant, which actually in the end was a sales job, selling pensions and bonds mm-hmm. and things like that. I did that for a few years, and I met a lot of nice people, but I hated it.
Sure. You know? It seems like this is, this happens to so many people, I think, who end up finding themselves in kitchens that they did not like a prior career.
Mm.
It was misery for them.
Yeah, so anything else would
anything else, right.
But
that nothing but the kitchen would do ultimately. That, I mean, the way I look at it is they really seem to just be, I've met so many people who were doing something else, or even for a lot, this was not the case with you, but people who really almost metabolically incompatible with formal education.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
People who end up
cooking. True. Yeah, yeah. I think there is also a certain amount of desperation where if you end up in a kitchen, you want to be there for a reason.
Yeah, that is what
they say. It's the worst place in the world if you haven't got a real reason. If that's one of the big differences, you know. When I went into a kitchen, I was so motivated that I shamed other people. Not deliberately, but accidentally, because I was so motivated and in such a hurry.
Yeah.
You know, that they often would look at themselves and think, God, this guy's going somewhere and I'm, what am I doing here? That, that was common, a common feeling.
I'm sure it was.
You know.
So tell me, you had a, you say in the book, I hope we're not, technically I consider this a cookbook.
Mm.
You do tell quite a bit of your story, so I hope I'm not, I hope I'm not going to spoil anything as we're talking. But you do say in the book that you don't necessarily believe in what you refer to as light bulb moments, but you do have a few light bulb moments in your career.
It's difficult, isn't it?
But why don't you tell me about this dinner in 1992, this formative dinner that you experienced?
Yeah, well, I was a good amateur cook.
Mm-hmm.
So, for example, friends, you know, would come around and watch the football or soccer, and I'd, you know, bunch of guys back in the 80s watching football, I'd be making pizzas or kind of, you know, Turkish food from a book or something. You know, I would always cook for my friends. And that was, you know, that was quite unusual back then. I didn't think of that much, but I was a very good amateur cook. And so I knew my way around ingredients in a kitchen and all that stuff already.
And this was, again, just as with the guitar, this was self-taught.
Yeah, yeah. But I loved it. And I'd have to really rack my brain to think where that all began. But I just loved cooking. But as I say, I was just a good kind of amateur cook, cooking for pleasure and to give people pleasure.
Yes.
You know, that's very important, I suppose. And I, what happened was that because I was in the financial industry, I ended up, if we had a good month, we would end up going to a good restaurant.
You and your colleagues?
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah, my colleagues from work. So I went with two other colleagues, a guy called Luke, a guy called Mark, and we went to Chez Nico at 90 Park Lane. Now, I'd never heard of I didn't even know what a Michelin star was.
Right.
Now everybody knows, you know, like in England, you know, everybody, you know, even 10-year-olds know what Michelin, you know, I get my little cousins or, you know, coming up and saying, have you really got a Michelin star? You know, so everyone knows. I didn't know what one was, and I was 30.
Mm-hmm.
And I went and had this meal, and it was a 2 Michelin starred restaurant in Park Lane, so very expensive, at a very posh hotel. And it blew my mind.
What blew your mind about it?
The perfection, the concentrate. The everything tasted elevated, like a colour brighter than you've ever seen, and all this kind of stuff. Perfection, geometric perfection, the way everything was laid out. And the guy whose kitchen it was a guy called Nico Ledenis.
Sure.
And he was actually on his way to his third Michelin star. So I didn't know, but I was eating in a kitchen that was on fire,
mm-hmm.
that was 2 years off getting its third star.
Yeah.
And I hate to say it, but it was really tough getting three stars back in those days. So I had this meal and it blew my mind. The lemon tart at the end, I actually collapsed like an idiot laughing, because it was, you know, when the only reaction is to laugh,
yeah.
often in adversity.
Yes.
You know, it's like, and that was what happened.
You didn't
to me.
Have words for it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And just laughter came,
yeah.
because it was so perfect. Geometrically, it was perfect. I tapped the plate and the lemon tart wobbled, and it's like, surely this is impossible, you know?
Yeah.
It was this perfect wedge of bright yellow lemon. And then the taste was just amazing. And I had to find out how they did it. I don't know why that is part of me, but, you know, it's like if I hear a bit of guitar that I really love, I have to find out how to do it.
Right.
I always said it's like killing the thing you love, you know, Oscar Wilde.
Yeah.
Each man kills the thing he loves.
Yes.
And it's almost like you kill it. When you learn it, it becomes ordinary. And
right.
It's like,
well, it's like the magician's code, right? That
yeah.
you're never supposed to give up the trick,
yeah.
right? Because it won't be. Or seeing seeing how they do the special effects in a movie.
Yeah, it will ruin the illusion.
Yeah, and but you wanted to have that knowledge.
I've always had that.
That was an irresistible
yeah.
impulse for you.
It's like, I've got to find out how they did this.
Yeah.
And
but for you, I sense it enhances it.
Yeah,
that
yeah.
it doesn't actually diminish.
No, because I'm familiar with the feeling now. It's like when you conquer, you know, trying to play the. You know, the guitar solo off a song that I've loved, you know, Nowhere Man by the Beatles. There's this brilliant guitar solo in it, and I learnt it, and now it's no longer magical, but
right.
I still love it.
Yes.
But it doesn't quite have that magic because I know how it was done.
But you retain the memory of the first time you
yeah,
experienced it.
I try to. Yeah,
yeah.
That's the trick. It's
yes.
trying to keep things fresh.
Yeah.
You know, when you're tasting things and remember that, you know, those magical moments. So then after this meal, I had some friends coming round for dinner
yeah.
the next night, so it's Friday lunch. So Saturday night, I had a group of friends coming round. And I just thought, I know, I'll try cooking the meal that I had at Nico's. So the first course was a raviolo, meaning one single large raviolo, of salmon,
mm-hmm.
a salmon kind of mousse. So, you know, I made the pasta. I was already good at making pasta. I used to go to Italy on holiday and things. So I made the pasta, I stuffed it with the salmon mousse and then, you know, crimped it all
mm-hmm.
around and cut it with a cutter. And just thinking, and then I made the sauce, and the sauce, I suddenly realized, God, he really exaggerates flavors. You
yeah.
know, that's what I'd noticed. So I was reducing down the fish stock and then the vermouth and then adding the cream and then tasting it and then realizing... in the book, he says a squeeze of lemon, and normally I'd have left that bit out, but I put the lemon in. I thought, wow.
No, I'm sorry, this was his book?
The chef had a book. He had a book,
okay.
And I'd already got that book, but I'd never really paid that much attention to
right.
the details of it. But I think I'd worked up to this meal
mm-hmm.
for a few weeks before. This is what I mean about light bulb moments, you
yeah.
see. Probably wasn't like in an instant. It was probably over a period of time.
And you have a good enough taste memory that you were you were able to remember
yeah.
what that meal you'd experienced in the restaurant
tasted
like.
Yeah, it was only the
like.
Day before.
Yeah.
Mm. And then I suddenly realised. So I did that and I made the lemon tart for pudding. And the fact was that the flavours were there.
Yeah.
And my friends were blown away. They were
yeah.
like, wow, how did you learn, you know? So that kind of made me realize that I was onto something. And lots of friends, like I then carried on doing this. So Marco Pierre White, I got his book. I already had his book, actually, White Heat,
mm-hmm,
but I hadn't
sure.
been to his restaurant. It was like gastro porn. You know, you had the book before you went to the
yeah,
restaurant,
right.
you know,
yeah.
and he looked like Keith Richards, and he still sounds like Keith, you
yeah,
know, he
sure.
kind of
yeah.
talks like this, you
yeah.
know, kind of like a, you know, kind of a weird. There's something. I think Keith Richards and Marco Pierrot might be the same.
That's
person.
Very. Yeah.
You know,
I've never seen them in the same room.
Exactly. Which is proof.
I've never seen either of them in a room, but
so yeah, just they
beside the point.
They amazing kind of. The Marco Pierrot's food as well. So I suddenly got into that whole world of, you know, oh, Michelin stars. Oh, right, you can get three. This has got two, blah, blah. What other restaurants are there in London with Michelin stars? And then the Roux brothers and Pierre Kaufman at Le Temps Clair and Marco and all that. So I would go to their restaurants, eat the meal, and then go home and try and cook it.
Yeah.
And so if I saw something on the menu that was I knew was in the book, I'd order that. But just the general spirit was enough. You know, how far these guys pushed flavour, pushed seasoning, and just worked out. And then there'd be tiny little clues in the book which you'd miss. You know, nobody would say that's really important, you know.
Right.
Like, say, you know, for example, you're making a reduction, a sauce, like a meat sauce.
Yeah.
So, you know, you fry off the bones and some vegetables and then you pour stock over it, let it infuse, you know, in the oven for an hour or so, then strain it off, reduce it. How far do you reduce it? Then, you know, you'd know by the taste in the restaurant how far they took things.
Yes.
And then at the end, Marco used to say, add a few drops of lemon. Yeah. And it was like, but it's a meat sauce. I don't want my meat sauce, you know, my lamb jus that I've taken out days to make. I don't want it to taste of lemon, but that wasn't why he meant it. The reason you put the lemon in is to increase the acidity so that when you put it in your mouth, the sides of your cheeks would salivate. And it gave the illusion that the whole mouth was being stimulated by this food.
Yes.
So that's what it was about. It was about balancing the dish and all those kind of things. And I just taught myself all that. And then I was quite methodical for a bit. I bought Mastering the Art of French Cookery, worked my way through all
by Julia Child.
That's
sure.
right, yeah.
Did you cook your way through that book?
Pastry. I used it to learn pastry. Stocks, maybe. I really did go to town, and I kind of educated myself. I taught myself in a methodical way. So, you know, I made veal stock in my little flat in North London. And then I took the veal stock and made made the sauce that you make from veal stock, you know.
Demi-glace,
that's it. Yeah. So the reduced, you know, so you take the veal stock, which has already infused the house with its unique and stickiness, and then you make a demi-glace with that veal stock.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it would take 2 or 3 days, and you know, getting veal bones and roasting them and all those kind of processes. But the end results, when a friend would come round and have the dinner, you know, to have a demi-glace made, for your dinner party. So that was how it all kind of.
And at what point along this trajectory are you thinking I'm going to do this? This is going to be my, this is my calling. This is what I'm going
to. You know,
become
that bit. I don't remember too well. In the book, I talk about I went for a lunch with a friend, my friend Lindsay.
Yeah.
And she knew a chef. And we went to his restaurant and she just blurted out, Stephen thinks he wants to become a chef. And I wouldn't have done that. I was still kind of umming and ahhing. But she was...
This is one of your friends who had been to dinner at your home?
Yeah, okay. And they were great friends of hers, her and her boyfriend. I was with... her boyfriend was a guy called Michael that I was at university with.
Okay.
We were a big group of friends. We'd go out for meals together and all that. And she really knew about top restaurants.
Yeah.
And she kind of introduced me. That was how I ended up at Nico's because she loved that restaurant.
Okay.
So she was kind of more, she'd grown up in London, lived in the King's Road, you know.
Right.
That's kind of, you know, when you're kind of more worldly if that's, you know, where you've hung out.
Yeah.
And she blurted that out. And the guy, the chef of whose restaurant it was, who was a friend of her family's, said, well, come and do a week here and you'll know. There'll be a time in the week when you'll know what
the answer is. I admit, this is in the book. What did he say? You'll know by Wednesday you'll know by Wednesday.
I think he was right as well.
Yeah.
It was like Wednesday afternoon. And I just had this kind of feeling of, wait a minute, I feel really at home here.
Yeah.
This is what I love. I'm learning, I'm teaching, you know, and I'm being paid for it. And not that the money was any great shakes, but it just felt, I just knew. I had this feeling. I knew.
You felt like you were home.
Yeah, yeah. Really strange. And, I mean, there were other competing thoughts, you know, like, God, this is the tough choice, you know?
Right.
Like, I can earn decent money and, you know, and have a nice, you know, kind of easy life.
Yeah.
Or I can do this, and it's going to be hard.
Was age a consideration?
Because
you were a little, I mean, by kitchen, to start a career in a professional kitchen, you were, I mean, no disrespect, but you were what we call over the hill.
Yeah.
Here.
Right,
yeah.
Quite right.
Yeah.
Quite right. No, I was.
I mean, just physically.
Physically, I was fit as a fiddle because I played a lot of football and I was at my fittest in my early 30s.
So you had the stamina that wasn't...
Yeah, but you're right. People, I got the weird looks because not only was I physically, I was older.
Yeah.
I was 10, 15 years older than everyone I was working
with.
I was also from a different background, you know? I mean, there was nobody to chat about, you know, Proust or, you know, Thomas Hardy or all the things I might be, you know?
There weren't any other former history teachers in the room.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And it was a bit strange.
Yeah.
But luckily, they were all such nice, welcoming people. You know? Everybody, you know, there's a little bit of the shit together.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, yeah.
And we're in it together and we're a team. And there's a great bond in kitchens.
Yes.
I learned that. So, you know, I might have brought something to the gig, but... I learned so much from chefs, you know, camaraderie.
Yes.
You know, I suspect it's the same in the army, you know?
Yeah.
You never leave any, you know, if a guy goes down, everybody jumps in, you know?
Sure.
If you wake up in the morning and you're feeling really rough, you still turn up to work because you don't want to let your mates down.
Yeah. That also forges, I mean, it's interesting. I was going to, maybe this is the back way into what I was about to ask you, which I was going to ask you if it was for you coming in as someone older, someone of a different background, if it was at all socially uncomfortable for you, but again, the intensity of the environment you're creating does tend to make for quick intimacies. I mean, you do tend to become, I mean, people do use the expression, we're war buddies. I've heard cooks say that who came up in a kitchen together.
It's like the trenches.
Yeah.
And they, it was about as hygienic as the trenches in some places. You know,
but did that erase those lines that you perceived when you first came in? In other words, the social lines or the lines of age difference?
Yeah, and you realise that there's an awful lot of snobbery and, you know, just rubbish about, you know, about all these things. People, you know, there are decent people and there are idiots in every walk of life, in every strata of society.
Yes.
And you'll go down to a kitchen... And there'll be somebody and they'll have nothing, but they'll give you anything, you know?
Yeah, sure.
And you suddenly realise that people are, you know, there are just great people about. And you shouldn't make any judgments on anybody.
Yeah.
Never, never underestimate just how great, you know, people can be.
Well, the other thing that I find is, I made the comment a minute ago myself, you know, there are a lot of people who end up in kitchens who... They're just bored by school.
Mm.
They just are. They like to do things that are physical. They like to be on their feet. They like to they like that camaraderie you're talking about. They like the noise of a kitchen. I think a lot of people make the mistake of confusing that profile with a lack of intelligence. I think a lot of those people, they may not have flourished in school, but a lot of them have I know a lot of chefs who are actually, it's funny, are fascinated by history. I have one friend who's fascinated by presidential history.
Right.
They're often very, they have a huge social IQ, very quick-witted, very street smart.
Yeah.
I mean, there's a lot of ways, for intelligence to express itself.
Exactly.
And I feel like you find a lot of people of whom that statement is very true in kitchens.
True. Tell me about it. I mean, people will shock you everywhere you go.
Yeah.
No, I totally agree. And I became very, you know, I know it sounds a bit corny, but I was humbled by
sure.
it. You know, because I think I'd gone in maybe thinking, you know, the worst. But actually, I was working with these great, great people.
Yeah.
And as you know, as you say, there was a camaraderie. And also, yeah, you're right about the intelligence thing. I mean, never underestimate people. You know, you'll meet someone and you think they can barely string a sentence together. And then they'll hit you with what they love. And when you hear about that, they're totally eloquent.
Well, and also people who are just innately great negotiators. They can make very good business people.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Skills, which I just think that academically, and having been a teacher, I had early experience of similar things where the kid who wasn't that bright but was really gifted in certain areas.
Yeah.
And I just always thought that we failed them, you know, because we had this narrow idea of what intelligence was. And
right.
you had to express yourself through the pen. And yet some people just weren't, you know, that just wasn't their gig. They weren't, you know, they weren't able to do that, but they were brilliant at other things.
Sure.
So you'd get a kid, you know, who knew all about, you know, birds or something like that.
Right.
And they, but their knowledge would be amazing.
Yeah.
And yet there was nowhere for that skill to flourish. And
right.
I always thought that was a failing of ours
right.
rather than theirs. And I still think that's the case. You know?
Yeah. Well, it goes back to, again, there's all these paths that are laid out, right?
Mm.
Like you yourself didn't want that professional path that was there.
That's right.
And I think for some people, it's the schooling path. The conventional schooling path doesn't
and
work.
A kitchen feels like freedom to some of these people.
Yeah. Right.
There's a freedom about a kitchen.
Yeah.
You can swear. Nobody's going to tell you not to.
Right.
You can do all these things, you know, that you can't do in ordinary life. And you'll get these people and you'll think, you know, and then you'll watch them cook and plate up and you think, God, where did that come from?
Well, I've seen, you know? If you've ever watched a cook come to work sometimes, they're almost like, it's almost like an alter ego. Sometimes they have nicknames that are unique to the kitchen. And the minute they walk in that door, something happens with their strut, with their whole energy elevates.
Yep.
You're an athlete. Yeah. It to me, it's similar to, you know, sometimes I'll be going to play tennis. I play every Sunday morning and I'll be 5 minutes from the court and I'll think to myself, I'm going to be a different person in 5 minutes. Do you know what I'm saying?
Yeah,
does this make sense?
Totally.
And I'm going to be that person while I'm on the court and then I'm going to revert to this person.
Yeah.
But I think for cooks, it's very similar. There's something that happens when they set foot into that environment. It's almost animalistic.
I think
they're unleashed.
I think there's something in that. And I think that, There's even more, even goes further than that. I think with anything, like when you go onto the tennis court, I feel that when I used to play cricket or play football, I used to play tennis as well. I'd imagine I was at McEnroe was my hero.
Sure.
And I used to serve, you know, with your feet along the baseline and twist. And I used to do that McEnroe serve and I'd get so much power in it. And same with football. But I would imagine I was a great footballer or a great cricketer.
Yes.
I would imagine I was that person.
Yes.
And then my body would move like theirs.
Yes.
And I'd feel almost, and you get that. And you also get that moment, and it happened with learning about food and cooking, where you feel like you're watching from above when you're so in control of what you do that you can almost pop out of your body and have a look from above.
Yeah.
And everything's flowing and going easy. And
yeah.
That feeling as well. No, there's all these weird things that happen when you conquer a subject. And I remember that feeling in other things I'd done. And when I came to cook, those feelings would come back again. I knew that I was kind of, things were going well.
Right.
You know, cooking for 40 people and you could still chat to someone.
Right.
But you're kicking oven doors shut and you're flicking fish in a pan and then you got something, you know.
That feeling of mastery.
Yeah, that you're totally on top of what you're doing.
Yeah,
that
it's funny. I was at a comedy club Saturday night and this guy was, well, I forget his name, but he was doing his 15 minutes or whatever. And in the middle of it, as he was talking, there was a stool on stage and he just pulled it over and he's just, as he was talking, kind of casually hopped up on the stool and kept, and I thought, I cannot imagine being so comfortable telling this, going through this routine in front of, I don't know, 150 people on a Saturday night in New York, that I would just pull up a stool as I'm doing it and just sit down.
Mm.
I mean, it was an amazing, he's conquered it.
Yeah.
He's in his element, as they say.
And there's, you know, you don't need all of your brain to be focused on something.
It's, right.
You're doing it, almost, you're just doing it. And then you've got room to, you know, look at it from above or whatever, you know.
Yeah.
So now that's, I had a lot of those moments when I was cooking.
So quickly before we go to break, can you tell me, there was, you know, you've talked about all your love for these Michelin-level restaurants, but there was an element of these restaurants that, you talk about this in the book, that you connect to your punk instincts.
Yeah, yeah, the elitism and the fact that you had to go to Park Lane and dress up to eat this food, you know.
And needed to have certain financial.
Yeah. Why? My view, even assets. Back then, was why can't you? Why can't we just have this food in a, you know, in a pub?
Yeah.
Because I felt like I felt that it was exclusive.
Mm-hmm.
I felt it was elitist.
Yeah.
And I thought, why can't you know, it can't be that hard.
Yeah.
You know, you don't need... And also, was there a way to do this without 40 people on the floor,
right,
without 30 people in the kitchen? Because in the end, if you whittle away all of the other stuff, it's a plate with a sauce,
yeah,
some vegetables, and a piece of fish,
yeah,
or meat or whatever. That's all it is.
And this was an I'll call it an epiphany that you,
yeah,
had. The way you describe it in the book, you had it at that first at Nico.
Yeah, yeah.
That was an immediate... you had a moment of clarity, I guess, that you were able,
yeah,
to sort of cut through... or see through all the layers,
yeah,
that were like, surrounding those things you just named,
yeah,
to the essence of it.
Yeah, and I'd always had that a bit,
yeah,
you know. I had that with music. And,
right.
You know, the same thing, you know, a similar thing, you know, when all those bands were getting bigger than they, you know. I can always remember wanting it to go back to a little club room in a, you know,
three or four guys and
with a guitar, bass, and drums,
and that was it.
And you know, if it was good enough for the Beatles, you,
yeah,
know, in the Cavern, then,
yeah,
Christ, what, you know. And I never felt like it was progression to play in front of a lot of people. It was just a way of making more money. And I felt a bit like that with the restaurants. It was like, you know, it didn't feel to me like a lot of it was necessary. Actually, when I look back on it, to create a great restaurant, you probably do need 25, 30 chefs, you know, to do it. But I just thought, let's have a go and do this with four, you know, or,
yeah,
three. Or
right.
I started on my own.
Yeah.
The Sportsman, I was on my own.
Yeah.
There was no one else in the kitchen. So, yeah, you know, if I'm going to do that,
right,
how am I going to make this work?
Yeah.
So I just cut to the essence, you know?
So I want to get that story. We'll take a quick break, and we'll come back and talk about that. We are chatting with Stephen Harris of The Sportsman, both the restaurant and the book, which is now out. And we will be right back after this break. Like a four-leaf clover, shiny like the tannin bright, landing on all four feet like a cat who's ready for a wild night. My theme song and break music is from After School Specials album Double Barrel Single Entendre, which is available on iTunes.
I'm Michael Harlan Turkell, host of The Food Scene and Modernist Breadcrumbs on Heritage Radio Network. I'm here at Bob's Red Mill to find out from Bob himself why his products taste so good. So what's the secret, Bob?
To make the best whole grain flour, we look back in time. No modern technology can match the old world engineering of a stone mill.
Wow. Bob's Red Mill is using stone mills? How old are we talking here?
Well, the stone mills are practically as old as mankind, and no matter what civilization they uncover, they find two stones that people were rubbing together to make something they could eat, whole wheat flour. But the stones that we use are quarried near Paris, France, in La Ferté, and it's the same stone material from the same quarry that the Romans used to make stone mills all over the Roman Empire, of which you can testify by looking at Pompeii. It's a quartz material. It has a uniqueness about it. It's very hard. It has a certain porosity, and they put the stones together in a unit of 20 pieces and band it so that they use only the best and sharpest parts. It's an ingenious thing, but very old. I mean, thousands of years old, so it's pretty cool.
Those sound like some really special stones. How do they work?
Stones turning either the top or the bottom stone, turning at 100 to 125 revolutions per minute, produce a lovely 3-4 up to 500 pounds, depends on how soft the grain is. The bottom stone is the bedstone, and it's also called the nether stone in the Bible, but it also now turns for some configurations.
Would you say that using stone mills lead to healthier grains?
I know they do. I can watch it. I showed you. You know it as well as I do. The grain goes in the top, goes through the stones, and it comes out. We don't lose anything, and we don't add anything.
Thanks for sharing the story of how Bob's Red Mill is using ancient technology to keep their products on the cutting edge.
Michael, we think that we can make a difference by sticking by the traditional way of stone milling whole grain, and that's what we're doing.
You can learn more at bobsredmill.com/podcast.
And we are back chatting with Stephen Harris of The Sportsman, who has burst into song during our break.
Do you know what it is?
I don't.
It was Here, There, and Everywhere.
Oh. I'm embarrassed to say I didn't write, but I do know that song.
Or it was just a bunch of chords.
It was just some chords, though. We don't know. Right, we don't have to. We don't know royalties for that song. No,
I think they've got enough.
We don't want to. Well, that's true too. But we don't want to bankrupt Heritage Radio Network. So, Stephen, tell us the Sportsman. Well, there's an if you don't and you don't have in some short version. Mm-hmm. Why don't you tell us about the moment of. Rediscovering, I guess, this space and its potential and how it fit with the way you were starting to think about the kind of restaurant you might like to have.
Well, I'd been looking for a restaurant for about 3 or 4 years, and I kind of worked in friends' restaurants to teach myself how restaurants worked. I taught myself to cook separately.
Yeah.
And I worked in a couple of friends' restaurants. But there was just one day, it was Boxing Day, the day after Christmas. I was out with a friend in his little convertible blue MG Midget. And we used to go out for a pub, like for a pint at Christmas to get away from, you know, Christmas. And we were on our way back from somewhere and we went down this funny road in Whitstable, which runs along the sea. It's a totally deserted road. And we came across the Sportsman and we remembered, oh, look, it's the Sportsman. I haven't been in there for years. Let's pop in. So we popped in to have a quick drink before we went home. And I'd been looking for a restaurant or a pub or somewhere to cook. I'd put offers in on places, all that kind of stuff. And anyway, we're sitting in the back bar and just slowly, as my friend was talking to me, I suddenly realised I was kind of looking around and I suddenly thought, wait a minute, it's a big building. It's kind of got a car, it's got a car park, because my dad always said, because he was the real estate agent, he would say, always find somewhere with a car park.
And that's great.
So, and then gradually, but it was such a disgusting looking pub.
Yeah.
It was hideous.
How big a space?
It's big. I mean, it's a big old, I can't really imagine. It's got one big front bar and two side bars.
Okay.
With a kind of conservatory on the outside.
Okay.
It was a big space, but the thing is, it had been a hotel for visitors to the sea.
Yeah.
But then English people started going abroad on holidays to Spain and Greece and countries like that. So it had lost its reason to be there.
Yeah.
And so it was dying. It was dying. And you could see that.
Yeah.
And nobody could make it work because there was no village, there was no town. Why would you have a pub in a... in the middle of nowhere. It was by the sea, so in August and July it would do well because there were a lot of people coming down. But, yeah, so anyway, I was sitting in that bar and I just thought, this is the place, you know.
Right.
And so I set about trying to get hold of it. It was a brewery who owned it. I knew the brewery because I'd done a bit of work for them as a chef.
Yeah.
In fact, they wanted to kind of take me on as a kind of... what's that when you go in and try and sort problems out, you know, a bit of a
like
kind
a
of
corporate a, chef or a consulting
yeah, yeah,
chef.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. Because I, you know, I think because I was, you know, quite well educated, they fell for that old he must know what he's talking about. So I'd done a bit of troubleshooting for them. I'd been to a pub and sorted out a kitchen for them. So I knew them. So I contacted them. My brother, Phil, who's a partner in the business with me, and I then put in a kind of a bid, not a bid, but we said, look, anyway, cut a long story short, 6 months, 8 months later, we got it.
So the restaurant opened in 99.
November 99.
Is this, you bought the restaurant in 99?
We bought the lease.
In 99?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yep. Yeah, yep. Yeah. And we opened just before the millennium. So we had 2 months in the last century.
Wow.
That was going to be the... I wanted to call the book The Sportsman, a 21st Century Restaurant, but I didn't.
Oh, well.
Yeah.
As in, I don't know if anyone would have taken you to task for that. No, but you... So what was your original vision for this restaurant? Did it kind of go back to that moment where you wanted to sort of have this stripped down? I mean, I love the way you apply your punk sensibility to this in the book, but this sort of stripped down, the making food that would be that pleasurable to people. And I guess that's sophisticated, we would say, accessible to anybody.
That was
kind of the mission.
Yeah, the idea was that, you know, in the end, it's just food. So take something like pork, you know. So what's the difference? In those days, posh restaurants didn't serve pork.
Mm-hmm.
Isn't that amazing?
Yeah.
You know?
Why?
Because it wasn't regarded as highfalutin enough, you know. They would, it would be, you know, they'd serve fillet of, but, you know, fine dining. They're just idiots, you know. And nobody said, asked why.
Yeah.
Nobody said, why do you only serve that little strip of meat out of the cow?
Right.
You know? Why do you serve? And it just was idiotic to me.
This to you went hand in hand with the sort of pretension of the rest of it.
And they strip out all the fun, all the flavor. Like, you know, they were too posh to chew or something like that. You know, why? I didn't get it. And some chefs were breaking against that. You know, Marco Pio-White did things like daub of beef. And so there were other people doing it. But I just found fine dining absurd. And I just thought there was a style. So I wanted it to be like country cooking taken to its ultimate. Really kind of, you know, like the sauces, all beautiful jeweled sauces that sparkled. Meat that was perfectly cooked. And I very quickly realised, you know, cabbage from the farm down the road that was just picked that day and then served, but really simply, just tossed in a bit of butter and a little bit of lemon juice and salt, and that's it, you know. So to let the real taste, because I just found I'd go into fine dining restaurants and I'd know that was supposed to be ratatouille, for example, but you couldn't taste anything because they diced it up so small. You know, there was all these kind of...
And cooked it until it all sort of mushed together, right?
Yeah, and there was no
nothing
flavor.
Nothing was decipherable.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. You know, you couldn't go, oh, just got a bit of courgette there or zucchini for you.
Sure.
And all that kind of stuff, you know.
Thank you for the translation.
That's right,
from English.
Yes, that's right, yeah. So I just kind of felt like the whole thing was misplaced. So I wanted to take all the good things from fine dining, like perfectly cooked meat and fish, beautiful sauces, all the really good things like that.
I don't mean the standards like the usual things you expect. I mean the standard of excellence, the standard of flavor.
Exactly, exactly. The seasoning, you know, well seasoned.
Yes.
You know, not forgetting to season something. Mm-hmm. You know, that's, you can't have that.
Yes.
So all the really good things about fine dining, and then edit out and get rid of all the silly things.
Yeah.
You know, like waiters running to kind of move your chair and take your napkin and follow you to the toilet and all that stuff, you know. It just drove me balmy.
Yeah.
And, you know, like you, or pour your wine. What's wrong with you? Can't you pour your wine, you know? And now I understand why they do it a bit more, you know, they might claim, but I've never got that.
You mean you can understand to some degree why people might want that experience to come with a certain amount of pampering or...
Yeah, you know, it's a treat. It's your birthday. You go to a restaurant.
You want to be spoiled a little bit.
They pour your wine for you.
Yeah.
But, I mean, I still prefer to pour it myself. But I'm a bit more relaxed. I used to have to fight them off, but now I don't bother. But, you know, if you're going out, you know, to your local pub to eat a meal in the evening, you know, on a Wednesday night, do you really want all that?
No.
Fuss
no, you want to be left alone.
Exactly. Yeah. And you don't want to put on a jacket and a tie. I was amazed at the amount of good restaurants in New York that tell you how to dress.
Yeah.
It's like, not only do they want $300, they also want to tell you how you dress.
Yeah.
And I just find that astonishing.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, mind your own business. And I'm not trying to be confrontational about it. I just find it really surprising.
Yeah.
You know?
Interesting. So... there's two things I'd love to talk about. These, again, are in the book, but they're also very... Well, not also. The book is The Sportsman, as is the restaurant. Mm. The way you... the analogy you draw between music and food and how you look at the composition or the construction of different types of flavor in a dish. Can you just speak about this for a moment? Because I really think it's interesting.
Yeah.
So what's the baseline in a dish?
Well, I mean, I kind of, what happens is that I realized that when you finish a sauce, so let's say you've just made a lovely daub of beef, you know, slow braised ox cheek with a red wine sauce. So you've made it all. You've got the daub of beef. You've separated it. You've reduced down the sauce.
Yeah.
So you've got a lovely red wine sauce. Now, how do you finish it? Now, that just suddenly reminded me of when you're in the studio and you're EQing. So you're mixing a track.
Right. Now, EQ stands for?
Equalizing. Mm-hmm. So it used to be, I'm so out of date with the technology. You used to have things called graphic equalizers where you could take all the range of, you know, all the ranges that from the treble to the bass.
Yes.
And you could adjust them.
Yes.
Until it sounded right to your ears.
Yeah.
And I would always have to put more treble on because I'm a treble kind of person.
Okay.
And I was the same with acidity, which is hence the lemon, you know, in a meat sauce. You know, I'm not adding lemon, I'm adding acidity.
Yes.
And we, in fact, in my kitchen, we, if you want a lemon, you say, can you pass the acidity regulator?
Is that right?
Yeah, because I wanted people to challenge what the notion of a lemon was. It has many functions and roles. So I just reminded me, hang on, so the lemon is the treble.
Yeah.
Salt's the kind of base, you know, and you can adjust those really easily.
Yeah.
And then the middle is difficult because that's umami. And it's that comes about through some processes. So, for example, you get concentration of flavour by various different varying methods. Salt, adding salt can help to boost the flavour.
Sure.
Adding lemon can help to widen the flavour in your mouth.
Yeah.
Just like you can when you're mixing a track. And then you know, what happens is there's something, you know, in music, compression.
Yeah.
So you hit a drum and it goes boom. Now, if you want that drum to sound tight, you add you compress the sound.
Yes.
And it goes doom.
Right.
And it focuses the sound so that when you're listening to it, you know, it has a percussion to it. It has a sound, you know.
Yeah, I love
the
this.
Same thing with the sauce. It's the same thing with the sauce. You can compress the sauce by reducing
That's
it.
Reduction.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But also, there are processes before that where if you got it wrong, you're never going to get it back. So, and it's the same in music. If there's no, for example, deglazing.
Yes.
If you've got a sauce and you want to deglaze this, and you deglaze when you fry the vegetables, when you fry the meat,
yeah,
when you add the tomatoes,
yes,
when you add the wine, each one is what's called an opportunity to deglaze,
yeah,
and therefore to exaggerate the middle flavors.
You're layering.
Yeah, it's layering. It's it's an opportunity. So if you're following a recipe and it keeps saying, right, fry the onions till they start to brown, now add some wine, you're now deglazing the pan, taking all those little nice bits off the bottom, then maybe you're doing that with the meat and deglaze it.
Yeah.
Every deglaze is a concentration of the flavor. So it just felt to me the same as making a really good track. You know, you had to remember all these processes.
Right.
Treble, bass, umami. You can add umami by what you add to the, you know, onion, mushrooms, dried mushrooms particularly, tomato. All these things make it more tasty, you know, because you're adding the umami. And I just felt when I was finishing the sauce off often, I just felt like I was mixing a track, you know? So that analogy just works with me. And I say in the book, you know, some people see food in colour, and I don't. Yeah. But I love the idea.
Right.
It's such a lovely idea. I wish I did. Wouldn't it be great? It'd be
really, you don't have a choice about that.
No. I mean,
it's how you're built.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. It's just what works for you.
And, yes.
And so then I, you know, and I realised while I was writing the book that there were so many musical analogies that, you know, that I thought, well, you know, I have to be honest with myself. So, for example, I would, you know, the idea of the perfect 3-minute pop song.
Mm-hmm.
There was a time in England when we had, like, the Jam and the Buzzcocks.
Yes.
Every 2-3 months, they'd come out with a brand new single. It wasn't even on an album.
Yes.
Drive Americans mad. It's like, why isn't that on an album? It's like, well, because it's a standalone thing. And so we'd have, you know, A Town Called Malice and Going Underground and Ever Fallen in Love with Someone You Never Fallen.
Yeah.
These were events every 3 months, perfect 3-minute pop songs. And I just loved that. And I just thought, why can't a dish be like that?
Yeah.
You know, just a beautifully perfect harmonic thing.
Yes.
And then you send it out and that's, you know, and that, and it inspires me.
Well, there's, I'm sorry, I'm not going to be able to name the exact dish, but in the book, there's a dish, it's just fish. And you say very pointedly in the head note, the introduction to the dish, that you love the idea of this particular, I think it has some kind of a parsley sauce on it.
It's a slip sole in seaweed butter.
Seaweed butter.
Yeah.
And you say that you wanted to challenge the notion of what a complete dish was, yeah. that you wanted, you didn't mind that people would receive this and say, where's the vegetable?
Exactly.
Right? This is sort of yeah. analogous to what you're saying
yeah,
right
yeah,
now.
Yeah,
this is a 3-minute single.
Exactly. Yeah. So why add some noodling on to make it
to
more?
Something that seems That's complete right. in and of itself.
Exactly. And yeah. all you do is you detract from that. And that dish was what taught me how minimalism works.
Yes.
I understood intellectually what minimalism was, but this is what, you see, that dish is a local fish,
yeah.
slip sole. It's Dover sole,
yes.
a small Dover sole. The butter's made from cream from the farm. The salt in the butter comes from the sea outside the pub.
Yeah.
And the seaweed comes from the beach by the pub.
Yeah.
So it's all just done from all what's around us. And it was so perfect and holistic and all the loose ends tied up. I just thought, and I thought, how can I serve this? How can I? And then in the end, the bold decision was just as it is.
Right.
Because if I added any more, I detracted
you would
from
dilute
what it,
it.
Was.
Yeah.
yeah. And then I understood, and I use the analogy of an art gallery. If there's one painting on a lovely white wall,
yeah.
you look at the painting. If there's
yeah.
50 on a red wall,
yes.
you're all over the place.
Sure.
You don't know which one to look at.
Yeah.
And that's, an analogy. So here is something perfect, and so we serve it as a starter
yeah.
with nothing else.
Right.
And it's better for that than it would be if I'd added anything.
Yeah. So this is a perfect segue. You just explained what goes into that dish and how it comes from basically right outside your door.
Yep.
Can you speak to me about how you apply the concept of terroir to food?
Yeah. Well, first of all, where we are, I didn't realize it until I was 5 years in that I am smack bang in the middle of the land that used to be owned by the kitchens of Canterbury Cathedral.
Mm-hmm.
It's in the Domesday Book, which was written in 1086.
Okay.
It was an audit of Britain ordered by William the Conqueror to find out how much
yeah.
tax and what he owned.
Yes.
And so I looked up Sea Salter, and Sea Salter, it said, the borough of Sea Salter, alert immediately, because I knew that borough, wait a minute, that's a special place.
Yeah.
Not everywhere is a borough.
Sure.
It had special tax status. I thought, why did it have special tax status? Next line said, is owned by the kitchens of the Archbishop of Canterbury.
Yeah.
So that's just weird, you know?
Sure.
Anyway, I met an archaeologist friend. Long story short, he was writing a paper.
This is your friend Tim?
Yep, Tim. Yep. He was writing a paper for the Archaeological Review in Kent about the area surrounding the Sportsman called Sea Salter Swine and Seafood. And the article was about how, proper academically researched and article was about how the area around the Sportsman was the larder for Canterbury Cathedral because of its unique location. So a terroir is a series of interconnecting features that make something special. So
yes.
here you've got a salt marsh. Now a salt marsh means that you can make salt because the sea floods onto it.
Right.
So they can make salt. If you can make salt in the Middle Ages, you could get through winter because you can slaughter a cow or a pig and salt the meat.
And preserve it.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
And then you eat it through the winter
sure.
until summer comes around again when there's stuff growing. That was the first thing. Then because it's a salt marsh, it's by an estuary.
Yeah.
When you've got an estuary, you've got seafood. So you've got oysters, mussels, cockles, wenkles, wilks,
yes.
Whelks, winkles, and everything. Estuary. Then you've got the sea because
yeah.
it's, you know, then you've got bass, turbot, brill, Dover soles, blah, blah. So anyway, then I found out that the farm that I'd been buying meat from was called Monk's Hill Farm. And I knew it was called Monk's Hill Farm, but then suddenly the monks from Canterbury. So I then found out that they'd farmed there.
Yeah.
And then I looked around all the hedgerows and there were, you know, elderberries, elderflowers, blackberries, sloeberries, all this stuff.
Yeah.
Then I went on the beach and started using the seaweed. Then I realised, it's called the Sportsman because they used to shoot.
Right.
And it was a game pub. And the birds came because of the estuary, because the birds ate the shellfish. And then all of a sudden I realised that it was this kind of holistic, rolling event.
Yeah.
And then, so I wrote down a list of everything that was in that area.
Right.
Of course it was a larder in the Middle Ages. They weren't idiots.
Right.
They had to. This was survival. This was life and death. You can't go down the corner shop and buy what they... This was life and death in those days. And so they had realised that this land was very special, that had all sorts of food opportunities in it.
Sure.
And that was why it was the Archbishop of Canterbury had given it to his kitchen and said, that's where you feed us from. Then at Canterbury Cathedral, Thomas Becket, the Archbishop, was assassinated in 1170, and suddenly masses of people came to pay pilgrimage to Becket. And so Canterbury became this tourist town, you know, full of religious tourists, pilgrims, and they had to be fed. So that's where a lot of it came from. And I used that as an inspiration to make a tasting menu.
This was a galvanizing moment in the restaurant.
Very much so. Yeah. It was the moment when I went from being somebody who copied other people's food, and that's how I taught myself to cook, to having a style of my own that was unique. And I'd worked that out. I'd realized that great chefs, Michel Bras, Oliver Rollinger, Pierre Gagnier, Alain Passard, all these great French chefs had all a style of their own. Gagnier, the kind of jazz chef, you know, Alain Passard, the gardener, Michel Bras, the forager, you know, they all, Oliver Rollinger, the spice historian. And that was when I realized, God, I'm onto something here. I can create unique food because my ingredients are unique because
Noun would you put to yourself?
Oh, blimey. Yeah, I don't know. I wish I could. Oh, that's interesting. You've got me there.
Would it be the historian?
Probably the historian,
Well, it's funny. Listening to you tell the story of your friend's research and how this sort of was a catalyst for you, it is striking that all of these moments in these phases in your life seem to have flow into this restaurant.
Yeah, yeah.
There's the punk.
Yeah.
The punk bit, and there's the history bit, and that's your culinary. I mean, it all seems to almost funnel into this restaurant, what this restaurant's become.
That's interesting, yeah.
No? I mean, it's...
It's a bit spooky, yeah. And I say in the book, there were a lot of spooky times when...
Well, it's that same essay where you say you didn't believe in light bulb moments, but it was getting to be spooky.
It was. And, you know, I don't know why. I was saying the Gary Player thing, the harder you work, the luckier you get.
Yes.
And I was working so hard that I think luck just falls into your lap when you work that hard.
What also seems to me, and I'm not just trying to flatter you, but it seems to me that you have, I've seen this in a lot of people, who it's just such a gift that to be able to recognize moments as they occur, right? To be able to have an epiphany, but then act on it.
True,
and follow it. And a lot of people have that light bulb moment,
but don't,
and then it just sort of passes.
Yeah, that's interesting.
But you seem to have a real confidence that in your own instinct, and I guess your talent or your work ethic, that you're willing to sort of chuck it all and follow. I mean, even the way you change the the offering of the restaurant based on this, this paper your friend was writing.
Yeah. I think a lot of things just appeared. It seemed like a beam of light. It seemed obvious. It seemed like a path. I have to follow that.
Yes.
You know, this land was owned. It was the larder for Canterbury Cathedral, and I'm in the middle cooking a bit of it, you know, some of this stuff.
Yeah.
You know, I'm using their old farm, you know, and there's... And around that time, you know, I suppose people were starting... This idea of cooking the landscape, you see, always appealed to me.
Yeah.
You know, when I wake up in the morning...
You were right on the cusp of all this.
Yeah. Well, that was the thing was... That was the weird thing, was that we kind of... What was a little idea in my part of the world, I suddenly met other chefs from, you know, like Rennie Redzepi at Noma.
Yeah.
Now, he was kind of a similar kind of thing, which is, you know, trying to cook from a landscape that didn't look that promising.
Yeah.
And yet he managed to make sublime... Now, I'm not comparing myself because his food is sublime. But he was along a set. And when he came to the Sportsman, he looked at me and went, "You've been doing this a while, haven't you?" Because I'd showed him all my experiments.
Yes.
Yeah, making our own salt and our own hams. And that's another thing that we did, was this artisan idea of making your own ingredients.
Yes.
So we'd make our own bacon, we'd make our own salt, we'd make our own butter. People would say, "Why do you bother? You can just buy them from a supplier." Sure. It's like, because they taste better.
Of course.
Now, the salt is one that I concede. That's a romantic notion. So I concede that making salt is romance, but what a notion. So, you know, where are you going to take your girlfriend to eat? Oh, I know this restaurant where they make their own salt.
Sure.
I mean, it's a line, isn't it? But the bacon tastes better. The butter tastes better than any I'd had anywhere else. So,
but it's also so consistent with what you've decided you wanted to be, right?
Yeah.
I mean, that it comes from the, you said, it comes from the sea just outside.
Yeah.
The restaurant, I mean, it's funny. I remember years ago, I was lucky. I've interviewed him several times, but I was interviewing Thomas Keller.
Mm.
And he made this comment, you know, in the kitchens at his restaurants, they use green tape to label everything. And they don't rip the tape. They cut the tape, right? Now, you can rip tape.
Yeah.
But it's part and parcel of, he would hate that I use this word because he's tried to shake it for years, but of his perfectionism that... You know, he would say you either do something a certain way or you don't. There's no on-off switch. And in his restaurants, it's exactitude is a defining thing, right?
Yeah.
And it seems to me in your restaurant, this devotion to being of the place where you are is, of course you're going to make your own, do your own salt.
Yeah, that's
why would
right.
you not?
Yeah, it and the landscape, you know, it's
why would that
it.
Be the thing you don't do?
Yeah, that would be crazy, wouldn't it? But as I say, it's such a romantic idea that we ran with it and it took us, you know, to where we are. You know?
Yeah.
And I think that's the appeal of that's why people come from all over the place. And,
yes.
And that, you know, sometimes I have to remind myself, you know, that I mean, you know, like things like when we started making our own butter.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was just my one silly idea. And I know why I did it, because my mum used to say when I whipped the cream on Sunday lunch, I'd whip the cream and she'd say, don't overwhip it or you'll get butter. And it was my mum's voice in my head when I had this litre of amazing cream, unpasteurised Jersey cream.
Yeah.
And it was just about to go out of date. And I thought, I can't throw this away. And then my mum's voice, don't overwhip it or get it. So I put it into a cup, blended the crap out of it, and I had butter suddenly. And now every restaurant you go to seems to make its own butter, or, you know, it's a big thing, you know.
Yes.
And yet I can remember the moment when I thought that and nobody made their own butter,
right?
You know, and now it's kind of become part of, you know, one of those things that you
it's
do
part of the moment. Yeah,
yeah. It's kind of, you know,
it's where we are now.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And I suppose accidentally, because I didn't mean all that, accidentally within this little project, which just meant something personal to me, developed an idea that took it beyond that and was attractive to a lot of chefs from, you know, because we get chefs coming from all over the world.
How fully formed do you feel at this point? Do you feel like there are more big evolutions in your future?
That's a great question. I wish I knew.
You're open to it.
Yes, I am. I am. I try to, you know, when you have such a big idea, it's like trying to follow it up. It's like the big album, you know, how do you follow up an album, you know? Well,
and you also don't want to make one album too, you don't want to make the album when they say, oh, he's lost it.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So, you know, I have other concepts, by the way.
Uh-huh.
So this, like, super local terroir concept is just one of the concepts I cook with. All they are is little ideas in the back of my mind.
Right.
I have this other one called Bistro Chic, and it's where it's a dish, and I have a restaurant in my mind where I'm walking through an old town in France somewhere, and I'm walking on cobblestones, and I come across a restaurant, and you go in and there's a genius in there, a genius cooking.
Yeah.
And you have this bright, beautiful food that radiates, and all the dishes are witty and funny. And that, I cook dishes for that restaurant in my head.
Mm-hmm.
So there are some dishes I do which don't fit the terroir concept, but would work in the chic bistro.
Can you tell me
in
one?
The back of my head. Yeah, I mean, I did one with smoked haddock with a curried carrot sauce, which might sound weird, but
not at all.
It's kind of a little play on kedgeree, but it's also a carrot soup, a bit like Bernard Loiseau used to cook.
Sure.
He was one of my heroes. You know, that kind of thing. It's bright, it's colourful, it's unexpected, and it has a certain wit to it.
Yes.
So I cook with that concept in my head as well. So,
and you say in your head, you mean that literally. You've never actually cooked these dishes.
Oh, no, I do these dishes. Oh, you have? And sometimes I put them on our a la carte menu, not the tasting menu.
Right.
Because that's very strict. Local.
That's the album,
exactly.
Right. That has, that's not the 3-minute single.
Yeah, that's right. It's the triple album. Yeah, that's right. So, I do. Yeah, and the 3-minute pop song. You know, so I try and get out a bit more often.
Yeah.
You know, rather than just wandering around beaches picking up stuff.
That's great.
But you know, when you know that idea that just happened to become, if you like, the big style of restaurants. You know, the super local natural. You know, foragey thing.
Yeah.
You know, lots of people were doing bits of it, but it all kind of came together.
Yes.
So, you know, I'm not claiming originality on it. I took some ideas from, you know, but it did seem to kind of, the history was what nobody else probably would have come up with.
Yeah.
You know, I think with history, you know, the idea of being able to read the Doomsday Book and find out what it said and understand the importance of it and where it led on to.
And also for you to be at the moment in your own evolution where you were at that point where you were ready to start conceiving dishes more from scratch, right?
Exactly, a style of my own.
Which again tracks your musical progression, right? From imitating the guy you saw on stage to being able to come up with your own
songs.
Yeah.
That's right.
Yeah.
It's interesting, isn't it?
It's fascinating.
Yeah.
The book, we should just say, I mean, everything we're talking about, I should say, this all tracks, maybe not in a linear fashion, but what's in the book. Your story is in the book, several essays that are all dated that talk about major stages in your own evolution and the evolution of the restaurant. Mm. We didn't really get to it, but that's fine. There's profiles of some key people in the restaurant.
Yeah.
There's beautiful photography throughout, and I think it's about 50... recipes of
50,
of food that's seems very a lot of it very doable.
Oh, it's very doable. There's a couple in there which would be tricky, but I didn't want to be patronized when I was learning to cook and I bought books, so I've worked on the same principle that like, I'll tell you how we do it in the restaurant
and then take it or leave it.
Exactly. And you know, you can work out how to cut corners or simplify it yourselves, you know.
And can we say people obviously people who have been to the restaurant can have the experience that you had as a young cook and try to replicate it.
Yeah.
And people who don't, can I take a leap and say you'd want them to probably apply their own taste to being bold, seasoning as they see fit, and going to a place where it pleases them.
Yeah,
and
not, of course.
And using acid and salt and all of that full effect.
Well, that's right. I think that if you read the book, I hope that because I've explained the process by which I learned and everything, I've had, you know, young chefs coming up saying they were really inspired by the story more than anything. You know, I'd love to read, you know, Thomas Keller. I'd love to read him writing about, you know, the moment that he found the French Laundry. I'm sure he has. You know, in fact, maybe he has. But, you know, all these people, because stories are interesting. Everybody's individual story is interesting. But as I say, and I've been saying it a lot lately, the reason it's interesting is because it worked.
Yeah.
You see, I could be a guy who'd opened a restaurant in the middle of nowhere and no one ever came.
Right. Well,
it could have been a failure. No one knows those stories. The reason it's an interesting story is because we, you know, we won the top restaurant in Britain 2 years in a row.
Yeah.
You know, it's kind of so, but I'm interested in everybody's story, but this one, I think, goes somewhere, you know. There's a, you know, I hope not the end of the story, but we've certainly reached a kind of plateau, a level, you know, which, you know. I think the main thing is I like the episodic nature of the writing because I think that appeals to people now.
Yeah.
Because it's a bit like, I don't know, a film like Pulp Fiction. You know, oh, have we gone back?
My language.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But,
I love the way he moves. Tarantino does that in his movies.
And the episodic nature. So when I first wrote it, I thought I was going to have to patch it all together.
Like a memoir.
Yeah. And I said to the editor, I said, we're going to have to put all these together.
Yeah.
And then she one day kind of said, sent me some, them as a And it was like, and it reminded me of Pulp Fiction. It was like, oh, right, back there, then there, yes, then there. And the episodic nature, it's like, treat your readers like adults. They'll get it. They'll understand that, you know, you don't have to put this all in one long piece.
No.
In fact, it's more digestible in essays.
So to speak. But yeah. it's also you know, I'm stunned, having written a number, co-authored a number of cookbooks with chefs.
Mm.
I was stunned when I first got told this, when we would do book signings and whatnot. You know, people do sit with cookbooks and read them, but I don't think they want to sit down and read them the way you read a novel. So I think the fact that it is broken up into these pieces does lend itself to the way people want to read these books. And also, the book is of a size, though, that you're not going to mind bringing it into the kitchen. It is meant to be cooked from.
Yeah. Clearly. Yeah, it's both. Yeah. I mean, you know, I hope so anyway.
Yeah.
The writing was fun. I mean, I really enjoyed the writing.
Yeah.
The recipes are like going back and doing the sheet music, if you like. Do you know what I mean?
Well, there's not a shot. I'll quote, I'm not going to get it exactly right, but one of my favorite lines ever about recipes, which is in the French Laundry cookbook, is that... you know, recipes and what chefs do are cross purposes to some degree.
Mm.
And the line that Keller has, the kind of the culmination of that paragraph in that book, is recipes have no soul.
Right.
The soul is what you, as the cook, bring to it. And that is the thing that
I remember that line.
No recipe will ever have.
Yeah.
Which is why I said what I said a few minutes ago, that people who do come to this book need to come prepared to infuse it with
something of themselves.
Something of themselves.
Yeah. True.
Can I put you on the spot? Can you just strum a little as we sign off?
You want to sign off? What do you want?
Well, first of all, I just want to say it's been great to meet you and getting your story and anything you could improvise. Okay, so as we fade out in Stephen Harris's hotel room in New York City, we're going to thank him for being here and recommend to you the new book, The Sportsman, out from Fiden. Currently available, and a great read, and I'm sure great to cook from as well. Stephen, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
And we'll see you back next week on Andrew Talks to Chefs.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.